All right, and it's my great pleasure to be here. And I've never given talks to so many theorists, and especially you guys are expert in graphenes. So hopefully we'll have a very fun experience. And what I'm going to tell you is the experiment we're working on a lot of focus on optics and actually combination of optical technique and electric transport. And we're trying to understand the optoelectronic property of graphene or graphene-like material, for example, you know, like topological insulator, they have these gapless surface states, this three-dimensional one. Or some material, they have a graphene-like lattice structure, for example, hexagonal lattice. And all these materials show very interesting physical properties. So we'll start with graphenes. The title is History of Graphene. Actually, that's not much history I'm going to talk about because you guys all know graphenes. It's just boring, right? But I'm going to tell you what, you know, what's important for the talk. So the basics is this is the electronic structure of graphene, and we know at the corner of these brilliant zones, there's a 60R point, and the conduction band and valence band touch each other. So everybody knows it's boring. And then has this linear energy momentum dispersion. So what's interesting then is the density of states is also linearly proportional to energy. What it means is the density of states is zero at the right point. And then graphene is more like, it's not really a metal, it's sort of like a semi-metal, right? This is the, this will come back to this point when I talk about these phototerms. So because the density state is small, it means we can tune the Fermi level in the graphene easily. So this is different from these conventional normal metals. In the normal metal, the divide temperature is much smaller than the temperature corresponding to the Fermi energy because we know, right? All the electrons occupy the whole brilliant zones. But in graphene, then it's different because we have these tunable density states. And we can have this, in graphene, the divide temperature is on the order of 25,000 Kelvin, and it can be larger than the temperature corresponding to the Fermi energy. So what it means is, then during the electron phonon interactions, actually, later on we'll tell you there's a so-called phonon bottlenecks. And then we can tune these electron phonon interactions by tuning the Fermi levels. And there's another motivation for this for this kind of photocurrent or photon and a graphene interaction, because a lot of proposals using graphene for optoelectronics applications, for example. So that's a lot of motivation with this. And for optoelectronic application, the fundamental is called photocurrent generation. So basically, it's input of photons, and we have output carriers. So this is photocurrent generation. It's very basic. And this is also the fundamental process for detectors or solar cells. Generally speaking, there's two classes of this photocurrent generation. The first one is photoelectric effect. So we have this kind of PN junction as an example. And when light coming, excite the electron hole pairs. Then this electron and the hole are going to separate by the building electric field across this PN junction. Then we'll get a current come out. All right. The second one is actually a photothermal electric effect. We know, you know, when I show light to any material, the material will heat up. And the materials has the ability to convert heat to voltage. So this is a photothermal voltage. Now, here I give you an example. We have two different materials, and they form an interface. So these two different materials, they have different ability to convert heat into voltage called thermoelectric power, or Seebeck coefficient. Assume they have different Seebeck coefficient, then when the laser coming heats up interface, then we're going to generate a thermal voltage across this interface. Then this thermal voltage will generate the current. So this is for the thermoelectric effect. Now, the question we want to ask is, what actually dominates this photocurrent generation is graphene with semi-metal materials. So this is a little bit review of photocurrent in graphene. The first one came out in 2008, and this is for scanning photocurrent microscopy. Basically, you know, this is a device image. This is a photocurrent image. You scan laser like me, just literally like this. I scan laser across this device, and then you record the current that come out of one device. Then you get an image. This is called photocurrent image. Then we can compare the photocurrent image to a device image and know where the current come out. So this paper demonstrates actually there's a pronounced photocurrent generation at a graphene metal kind of interface. We know, right, if we want to generate current, if there's homogeneous system, it's basically you cannot generate any current. So you have to break some, you know, spatial symmetry. So if it's a graphene metal contact that breaks the symmetry, you have a current come up.
So two of them are current contacts and two of them extra contacts.
Oh, this is just the image they, here, the device, there's a four probe device. So they're trying to measure the intrinsic resistance of graphene. Yeah. Yeah. Basically, you don't need a full contact. Yeah. It's just an image from the paper. You have a four probe device. Yeah. So, what we want to know is what is causing this photon generation, right? And the general picture they use is, at the beginning, everybody used this picture, basically adopted from this PN junction, like Schottky-Dowd, for example. You know, graphene and metal, they form metal contact, right? They form kind of a Schottky-Dowd junction. Then when light comes in, excite the electron hole pairs, this electron hole pair can be separated by the building electric field in these Schottky barriers, then giving rise to photocurrent. And this picture actually can explain all the data very well. But however, as I remind you, there's another effect called photothermoelectric effect. And at this graphene metal kind of junction, it's really basically these two effects give you same phenomena, and we cannot distinguish from one to the other. So how can we solve this question? And this is the work I've done in Paul McKim's lab when I was postdoc. We started with this simple device geometry called graphene interface junction. So we have a single layer and a bilayer graphene, they form an interface. What we found out is that this interface, the photocurrent generated by these two mechanisms I just told you actually have opposite signs. Then we can just identify what's the sign of photocurrent. We can identify what the mechanism dominate photocurrent generation. So this is very simple. This is a experimental setup. And we have a laser coming, and here's a scanning mirror. So what the scanning mirror does is we'll control the laser directions on a control laser spot and samples with them. You know, the laser is focused down to a sample only out of a 1 micron spot. It's diffraction limited.
So why bilayer and one layer opposite Z-beck?
Yeah, I'll tell you. Yeah, this just give you it'll be like that. There will more detail come up. So once we scan a laser and then you can scan across sample, you can get this two dimensional photocurrent image. But at the same time, the laser actually will reflect it by a sample. So once it's reflected, it will collect it by a photo diode. Then sometime we'll get a device image, like I just told you, right? Now we have a two image. One is photocurrent, one is device image, then we can tell where the photocurrent response is. This is called spatial resolved photocurrent response. All right. This is an example of the device we studied. This is a microscope image. Hopefully you can see it. We have a bilayer and a single layer, and here has an interface. And this yellowish is metal contacts, south end drain. And we first measure the conductance and function of a gate voltage. So we identify the derived point of single layer and also bilayers. Basically, they have a similar derived points.
That's the voltage scale.
So here? Yeah. It's a 15 micron. Now, I show you the examples of photocurrent image. So this is the reflection image, and it's a little hard for you to see here. Actually, from my computer, you can see very clearly we have a single layers, and then we have bilayers, and then they form an interface. And this is the photocurrent arise from this interface. You can see very clearly, if we overlap these two images, you will have photocurrent arising from this interface here. And this current is taking at a gate voltage 7 volt, which means the sample is electron doped. So we can control the polarity of the photocurrent by controlling gate voltage. For example, when we have in a hole doped case, we switch the polarities.
Just a question to your. So this was just a linear conductance on this?
Yes.
So just understand, so why it doesn't look so nice and so symmetric as we have?
Oh, I think it is just,
many other cases. So
it really is device dependent. Mm-hmm. Depends on, for example, what kind of impurity you have on a sample. This is it's not particular to my sample. We have samples which are symmetric electron homogeneity, for example, you know.
Okay. So but you cannot say what exactly was special for this sample. You don't know.
I don't know, because it's not what I'm trying to understand. Yeah, but I'm pretty sure lots of people working on this topic. Yeah.
And the neutrality point is in the same position because you're tuning the waves, it just happens.
It just happens. And we have samples, for example, we have different neutrality points. I'm not going to talk about it today, actually. And at least tell us the information. For example, when we look later on, we show you. You know, when I look, let's just start here. You will see. Yeah. So what I'm trying to do is we're trying to understand how the detailed gate dependence of this photocurrent. So what we do is we scan a laser across the sample, just one line. We keep doing it. You know, scroll across this. Then we change the gate voltage accordingly. So what we do is just like this. Then we have this. Map, this axis is gate voltage, this is a spatial map, basically a scan laser here, right? Then I will have photocurrent, this line, but this is what I'm interested in. This is photocurrent arising from the interface. And that's function of gate voltage.
And what the size of the laser spot?
The size is about 1 micron. Our laser is about 800 nanometers, so it's close to a diffraction limit. And a sample, like I just, you just told me, it's about 15 micron, yeah. So we extract this line here, and we get this curvature here. So this is a detailed photocurrent as function of gate voltage. And this is something related to the, for example, there are points. If there are points different, the feature will look slightly different. But we can well reproduce this by theory. But today I'm going to focus on the simplest case. That's why I will show you at the beginning the single and bilateral have some DR point. Yeah. If you're interested, you can go, you can check out my paper and there's some detailed stuff there. So what I understand was this tell us.
I'm sorry, arbitrary units on the vertical axis means what?
Yeah.
Special, no, the XNet plot, second one, yes. Special.
Special? Yeah, this just, like I say, from here to here is about 15 micron.
It's about 15
microns, 15, right. 1.5.
So the size of the spot is smaller, is actually smaller than 1 micron, right?
Yeah.
So this size is more or less comparable to the special resolution of the light source. The size of the spot, yeah.
The size of this spot?
Yeah.
Yes. This is limited by laser spot.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's, it is actually at this time. We're trying to look for example, at low temperature, see if we can get a the spot size larger than the laser spot. Actually, we cannot see it. I think it's limited by the mobilities, but you can just calculate it. Basically, the mobility we have is close to 4,000 to 5,000. That's not enough to, if you just translate it, the mobility basically on the diffusion lines on the other 400 nanometer, basically. So it's not enough.
Excuse me, do you come close to the source or the drain? Can you get a signal at the PN junction, it says, that forms precisely between the metal contacts and the graphene, or the
battery? You're saying here?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you have a current, but there's not much more. This is what I'm talking about, other people study. It's a little bit more complicated. But I'll go back to this actually later. We did a lot more measurements, shows. And basically, the feature here and here is similar. Yeah. So here, I just show you the simplest case, help us to understand what's really going on here. Yeah, like I say, so we're going to focus on this this side. This is basically electron doped. And the explanation for the whole dope is the same. So let's look at this. What data tell us is this is negative photocurrent, right? So negative means electron flows from single layer to bilayer in our connections. You have any question? I can. Yeah. No, it's fine. I mean, if you have a question, I can go.
This is just a cut for the color scale, right? With this curve?
Yes.
It's a cut by one particular, middle.
Yes, it's a dashed line, white dashed line here. So let's first look at this photoelectric effect, like Schottky barrier type thing, okay? And the single layer, they have a linear energy dispersion. So like I say, the denser state is linear proportion to energy. Then the denser state is very small, close to a dark point. And for bilayer graphene, we know as this kind of parabolic bands, right? Then, to a simple approximation, then the density states will be a finite number. So what it means is the density states of single layer will be smaller than a bilayer near your point. Then you can think of basically just like two cups. One cup can hold much more water than the other. Then if you dump the same amount of water into the same cup, then the level of one cup will be higher than the other cup, right? If you connect them together, then means the dual point of a single layer will be lower than the bilayer. In this case, the electric field will drive the electron from bilayer to single layer and give rise to a positive current instead of negative. Is it clear to you? You were asking this question. So in this case, basically you will have a electron flow from bilayer to single layer because of density state difference. Then this is contradict to the photocurrent current we see here. We see very strong negative photocurrent, not a positive. Now photoelectric doesn't work. Then we go back to this photothermoelectric effect. Then we have this electron and the hole come, you know, wait. Photon excites electron and holes, and then will relax real quick. Actually, I'm going to talk about later how they relax. But here, just take care. So electron hole, they combine, they relax, and generate a hot fermion you see here. So what it means is you have a hot spot across this single layer by the interface. Then we'll have a thermal voltage, right? Then let's look at this thermal voltage. So thermal electric power can be described by this model formula here. In Grothendieck case, we can consider is proportional to the density of states. Then, as we say, single layer has smaller density of states than bilayer. Then thermoelectric power of single layer is smaller than bilayer. So what it means is we have thermal voltage drive these electrons from single layer to bilayer, give rise to this negative photocurrent. So this hot electron will flow from single to bilayer and agree with the experimental observation we have. So this is just very straightforward. We look at the signs, we know actually this thermoelectric effect dominates photocurrent generation.
If you take the derivative of the
commutative,
the experimental
commutative,
it will be the same thing.
Yeah, this one I'm going to show you. Here. This is calculated, you know, just like you asked question. So we calculate it and agree with the data we have here. So if you go to my paper and you will see if the dual points are different and the feature, you know, this curve will be very different. But we see the same photocurrent pattern will follow that. Yeah. But The big question is, like I say, the sign just tell you, because the sign will go wrong. If you see the sign is negative, means one mechanism dominates. And whatever shape or the other things, they're all very detailed stuff. Right? It depends on the detail of your device. But there's more, you can look at this problem, you know, we don't have to calculate anything, just we think about it. What is thermoelectric power? So thermoelectric power, Seebeck coefficient, is just a measure of partial molar entropies of these carriers. So when your system evolves, they want to evolve into larger entropies. So means you have evolved into a system with larger density states. In this case, bilayer have larger density states than single layer. So electron will flow from single layer to bilayer, basically. Yeah. This is actually the measurement we have. This, although it's photocurrent, and we calculate the Seebeck coefficient here, but it agrees with Jenny Lau and the Philip Kings, their measurement on this Seebeck coefficient. The 7 mSv. Okay, and there's a lot of interesting detailed things coming out from this. For example, we measure the photocurrent as function temperature. And you can see at a high temperature, the photocurrent not as strong as a low temperature. So this is 10 Kelvin. So photocurrent actually increased by a factor of 10 to 15 when we lower the temperature. So we can do a detailed measurement. This is the amplitude of the photocurrent as function temperature. And I plot it as in a log-log scale. So once I plot it in a log-log scale, it clearly shows there's two kind of a, you can fit the data in the two lines and they cross around 100 Kelvin. So I can determine the slope of this. The slope is minus 0.5 here and the 1.5, minus 1.5 here. The minus sign, they mean actually a physical quantity. So we can understand this from this thermal photothermal current model. So the current is proportional to a thermal voltage, described right here, the difference Seebeck coefficient, times the temperature difference, yeah, temperature gradient. So the temperature gradient is it's proportional to, actually inverse proportional to the conductivities, right? Thermal conductivities. So we know that seedback coefficient has power law dependent to a temperature. Actually, the factor is 1. And at that time, there's a theoretical prediction. The thermal conductivity also has a power law dependence on the temperature. The coefficient is beta. Then if we just insert these two factors into the equation, we know the photocurrent should have this power law dependence and with a factor 1 minus beta. So this 1 minus beta, basically, if we take a log-log, right, on both sides, 1 minus beta will be equivalent to this to a slope here. Then we can infer this beta actually equal to 1.5 at low temperature and 2.5 at high temperature. 2.5 agree with graphite, but 1.5 shows what it means is the outer plane acoustic phenomenon actually dominates the graphene thermal conductivity at low temperature. And I will say this is the first evidence shows the outer plane acoustic phenomenon dominates the thermal conductivity. Later on, there's a lot of thermal transfer measurements coming out, so agree with our measurements.
And you're using silicon oxide for the substrate?
Yes.
So I suppose this out of plane phenomenon will disappear at some very low temperature.
It's still there, actually. From this thermal transfer measurement, they also do on silicon oxide.
You mean that even at 1 Kelvin or so?
We didn't go on 1 Kelvin. Actually, the lowest we go is about 10 Kelvin. I'm not sure it go even lower. That could be very different. Yeah. And at the lower temperature, you know, maybe disorder already dominates, and it would be causing a lot of difference. That's something interesting.
Does the slope change when you change the
kilograms? That's something we haven't really checked. I mean, I checked a few samples, and have a similar features, but I didn't check a wide range of characteristics. This one is basically it's very general, with only out of 10 to 11 to 10 to 12. I didn't check, for example, exactly closer to your point, how this will look like, and say we have a double hollow. I didn't check that. Yeah.
But does the crossover, the temperature dependence change when you change?
Yeah, I don't know. But this, I will show you something very interesting that probably related to the question you ask. So this is what I'm going to do, tell you. So now we have some understanding of this photocurrent use continuous wave excitations, right? And this tells us something interesting, but we don't know exactly how this electron phenomenon interacts and what the dynamics. Dynamics is more interesting, tell you a lot more physics. So this is what we build up at Washington. And basically, we add one arm into the system. Initially, you know, the highlighted by the dash box here. Without the dash box, you will have a standard photocurrent spectroscopy, and many groups they're doing this. But now we have these, we added this the other arm. So basically, when the laser light come out, now we use pulse the laser. So we have a beam splitter here. So the beam splitter will separate at least one pulse into two pulses, and then this pulse we call it pump, and will be controlled by these optical delay lines. Then we control the optical delay line, we can control the time separation between these two pulses. Then we can map out the carrier dynamics or photocurrent dynamics in the system. And since you guys are theorists, and I'm not sure how much you know about this ultra-fast photon pump probe spectroscopy. One thing I want to clarify to you is, you know, there's ultra-fast, like I said, there's ultra-fast pump probe spectroscopy, right? The photocurrent spectroscopy actually is very different from its optical spectroscopy. In optical spectroscopy, what you come in is, it looks similar. You have two pulses coming. Right? However, what the optical spectroscopy does is the probe pulse will be sensitive to electron holes with similar energies. So whatever happens near Fermi surface, this probe pulse actually doesn't know much because it's a different energy scales. Okay, the light coming, you know, at a particular time, and the light only see the carriers at this energy level. But in the photocurrent, what we do is we collect all the current after it relax. So it's a sensitive, it's a very sensitive probe to the Fermi surface. Okay, so this is the device structure we use, and now we use the graphene p-n junctions. The reason we use it because in a single, in an interface junction, I just show you, when you control carrier density, you control single layer barrier simultaneously. So we don't have independent control. Now we work on these PN junctions. then we have an independent control on the adjacent graphenes, basically. This is just a short example. We can use a top gate to control the graphene to be m-doped, and then we can use a bottom gate to control the graphene outside the top gate to be whole-doped. Then once they put together, we have a p-n junctions. So there's a lot more we can do, right? This is just to show you the conductance map, actually the resistance map as function of the top gate and bottom gate. We can form all different kind of Hummel junctions, either p-n junction or pp or nm junctions. And we did the first very simple characterizations. Let's just scan a laser across the samples. And this is a photocurrent image. The white dashed line here, this white dashed line, and this white dashed line shows the contacts, these two contacts. And the dashed line in the middle shows the top gates. So we see there's, you know, very pronounced photocurrent response from both graphene metal contact junctions. They have different polarities, that's reasonable. And you have photocurrent on the edge of these p-n junctions. They also have a different signs.
The gate in the middle is not transparent.
Not transparent, so we can only look at the edge. Now we turn on a pulse laser, and then these two, we use the same power. So these two parts are actually in the same color scale. So you already see a big difference, right? Use pulse laser, the photocurrent is actually very weak. You know, you almost see almost nothing, but they have the same power. So I plot them in the same, in a three-dimensional, so you can see the difference. This basically, when we turn on the pulse laser, the photocurrent actually strongly suppressed. So the first indication is we drive the system in a very strong nonlinear saturation regime. You saturate the system, so the system cannot respond to the light, generate the photocurrent. I mean, there's still photocurrent come out, just compared to a CW laser, it's very weak. Then we can utilize this nonlinearity to do ultra-fast pump probe measurements, basically. So we check the photocurrent amplitude as function of a temperature. So similar, I tell you, you know, for these ones, we will see CW laser, you see the photocurrent increase dramatically as function of the temperature. But however, with pulse laser, we see almost no change. So this is a strong indication. Basically, under pulse excitation, the energy transported by the carriers, actually, they don't care about lattice. The other means is how the carrier dominates the energy transport, not the lattice. I will show you a little bit more later. Okay, now we focus the laser on one of the photocurrent spots, and we scan the gates, both top and the bottom gates. We see these complicated patterns here. So this is photocurrent map. This is the resistance map as function of gate voltages. There's two interesting regimes, here and here. So I checked one line from here. So basically what it means is, as we tune the top gate, we fix the bottom gate here, you know, we extract the one line. So we fix the bottom gate and we tune the top gate. We can see the photocurrent actually switch sign twice. So what does that mean? So basically, if we look at it, let's go back to this photoelectric and the photothermoelectric model. So if we fix the bottom gate, and then we tune the top gate. So we can tune it from p-n junction and to pp junction, right? When we tune it, the electric fields at this p-n junction will switch sign once. So what it means is the photocurrent can only switch sign once by this photoelectric model. But however, if we use this photothermoelectric model, then once the bottom gate is fixed, so what it means is the seedback coefficient of the graphene outside the top gate will be fixed. Let's say fixed at this value here. Then we can tune the top gate. Basically, we tune the seedback coefficient of the graphene underneath the top gate. Then once we tune it, we'll cross the same value twice. So we can get the double crossing of this photocurrent. So the measurement here basically shows the photothermoelectric will also play a significant role in this graphene p-n junction, not only in these interface junctions. So the measurements we have here actually agree with the theory from Levitov group, and also later there's experimental measurements from Pablo's group.
Just one question regarding the change of sign.
Yeah.
So the change of sign did not happen when the back gate is smaller than
So does it mean that it's on a different origin?
It's a different. I mean, it's a little harder to. It's all changes, right? You know, see, but not twice. But it's a little harder to think of it in a baggage. You think about it in a baggage. You tune both. You tune the carrier density for both of the graphene on the inside tuple gate, outside tuple gate. It's a global changing. You know what I'm saying? You tune the carrier density globally. So it's not as clear as we. You just tune the carrier density individually. Yeah. So you fix the top gate. If, for example, you fix the bottom gate, then only this part of the graphene on the top gate, the carrier density will change. But if you tune the bottom gate, you tune both. And if you go back to, if you check this paper, actually, from, it also shows the sign change when you tune the bottom gate.
Yeah,
so in our particular device,
you have more
distinct sixfold symmetry. This here is also sixfold, but not as clear as theirs. Here's a, we can talk about that later. That's very detailed reason. I mean, you can get a sixfold, you can, or you get a different pattern. Really depends on your samples. Yeah. It's just a simple, very simple, right? Basically, it's a interaction between these two seedback effects. There's nothing else.
So this is continuous
illumination. This pulse. Yeah, this is pulse. Yeah, pulse. No, that could be a pulse. So from now on, we'll focus on pulse. But I mean, this pattern is cute, but I think it's a sort of a trivial because it's just a two seedback coefficient. They subtract each other. You can do whatever you want. Yeah. Now we turn on the pulse laser. And we first of all, I just show you the pattern, show you the dynamics. For example, let's say we scan a pulse and they cross each other. So this is a time zero. We fix the pump. We fix the pump pulse here. And actually, we fix the probe pulse here with scanner pump. When they are away of each other, you don't see much, right? It's a flat. So it means there's a pump probe, they don't talk to each other when they separate in very far in time scale. But when they overlap on the time, you can see very pronounced dip showing up here. The dip basically shows the saturation going on. So agree with the saturation model we just show you. If you remember the beginning, I say when we turn on the pulse laser, the folic are actually strongly suppressed compared to the CW laser. Now then we can manipulate saturation by tuning the separation between two pulses, right? You can think of when these two pulses overlap at time zero, so you have two power added together, then the system will get a stronger saturation compared to less power. Do you follow me?
The period of the pump.
Excuse me?
The period of the pump.
The PV?
Period, the time.
Okay. Yeah, it's a 13 nanosecond. So it's much more. You look at the time scale we're looking at here is on the other picosecond, 100 picosecond. So there's no, you know, lagging effects going on here. And that, just a side note, we also did same thing on the graphene metal compound. We show very similar behavior here. Okay, so there's something.
How does the waves in this photocurrent field compare with the pulse waves? I mean, if your saturation model is correct, does that roughly mean that it's twice or some three times the pulse waves? Because that's the overlap model.
Pulse rate, you mean?
So if you're just saying that it's because two pulses are overlapping and you're providing more power, and you're driving a higher saturation.
This is a very hand-waving explanation. It's much more complicated to just add the two parts together. Because think about it. Let me just tell you. Yeah, so it's more like you need to consider, for example, what's the special heat of optical phonons? What's the special heat of these carriers, right? And how these two special heat play with each other. What it means is how these electron optical phonons talk to each other to eventually give you a steady temperature. When I say steady is right after the pulse coming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so this is nobody knows actually. It's very complicated. Yeah. The temperature we have here is only out of from 1000 Kelvin to 2000 Kelvin. So at least high temperature, a lot of things change. For example, the special heat could have different formulas. For example, the seedback coefficient could have a very different formula. All the knowledge we have now, I think, I mean, to my knowledge, I could be wrong, but what I know is all the formula for this seedback coefficient is on the other like 500 Kelvin or lower.
What's the photon energy?
The photon energy is 1.5 eV. So if you calculate that, it's on the other probably 5,000 to 10,000 Kelvin.
And what's the pulse length in time?
It's 150 femtosecond.
What? Sorry?
150 femtosecond. Right? Is this what you're asking? The pulse width?
So it's much more than the.
Huh?
It's much more, much narrower.
Oh, much narrower. Yeah, in this scale, it's just a data function.
Yeah.
Yeah. So dynamics we see here is, this is a low temperature. It's only out of like 4 to 5 picoseconds. But if we do at a room temperature, it's only out of less than 1 picosecond. Yeah.
So in the previous slide, you compared these pulse measurement with the CW measurement, and you mentioned that you use the same power. But in one case, the power is concentrated to one small pulse.
Yeah, basically, that's the idea.
So can I understand that this pulse technique will give you a much larger delta T as compared to CW?
Initial temperature is higher, yes. However, like I say, you know, if we go into detail, let's say your specific heat, right? Your specific heat is proportional to temperature too. So when what it means is when your electron temperature goes higher, your specific heat goes larger, then you cannot raise the temperature to infinite, right? Because you know specific heat also gets very large. It's just a very first order interpretation to what you're asking. That's a lot of very detailed thing going on, and I don't think I fully understood because, like I told you, there's no specific formula for example, how the specific heat, optical phonons, or electrons at these really high temperatures. We can still use the model at low temperature, for example, you know, specific heat equal to alpha T, for example, things like that. You can understand it, but doesn't mean that it's correct. So here's something that's quite interesting. Like I tell you, okay, this is a saturation model, right? Then we fix the bottom gate, and we look at this photocurrent dynamics as function of.
So by saturation model, what do you mean? It's like population inversion, or what do you mean?
It's not a population. It's not a poly blocking type of saturation. In this case, what I mean saturation is more like the temperature. You cannot raise the temperature infinitely. So for example, you dump power into a system. Your carrier temperature will increase, right? In a linear regime, your temperature will linearly proportional to how the rise of your temperature will linearly proportional to how much power you dump into. When I say nonlinear saturation means now actually it's not linear. The ability of the carrier increase temperature actually gets suppressed. Yeah. So we're trying to actually we're developing a model how to relate it. Yeah. Yeah.
So what this time scale is 150 femtoseconds. Electrons already thermalized, we can already talk about temperature.
100 femtoseconds? The electron gets into quasi-semi equilibrium. Yeah. Yeah. It's only out of 1,000 Kelvin in this case. The power level, you know. The power level and the power, considering the power level pathways we have, it's about 1,000 Kelvin.
Is the electron in equilibrium with the phonons?
Not with phonons, with the sum of the optical phonons. Very few modes, yeah.
So electrons equilibrate with each other?
Electron equilibrate with each other. Assisted by optical phonons. A very few modes, not the old modes.
But attractions with phonons, how it's longer time.
That's acoustical phonons. That's what I'm going to show you very soon. 100 femtosecond, some modes of optical phonon already interact with the carriers. Then there's a more optical phonon coming, get a cool down the system on the other picosecond. Then there's a lot of different things coming. You know, longer time scale will cool it down more, for example. I'm going to show you very soon. Let's finish this part and then you will see that. Yeah.
So, can you quantify the number of photons?
Yeah.
So how many photons were absorbed
pulse? Normally I would say it's 2.3%.
No.
But the, I don't.
How did you know without telling me? Tell me how many were in the pulse.
How many in the pulse? Billion.
Hmm?
Billion. 10 to the tenth at least.
Okay. But can you recalculate into occupancy for the current states into transition?
You can, I mean.
You said
yeah.
The effect has nothing to do with problem. You don't see that it's quantitative sound state.
The reason I say that, you can calculate it, but the reason I basically compare, you can directly compare the experiment I do, for example, to the other experiment, they show the population saturation. The power level we use is at least an order smaller than those ones. So we don't think we have this poly blocking. So this gate dependence is actually quite interesting. So like I say, let's go back and let me repeat it myself. We fix the bottom gate, and then we tune the top gates. Okay. And at these certain top gates, for example, 7 volt, we see there is saturation with a dip. Now the signal is positive. Okay. This is positive signal, so we see the dip is kind of saturation now. But after we keep tuning this, okay. So what you see is at minus 1 volt, the signal actually it will still look like a dip, but it's negative. It's negative at the time 0. So the signal switch signs. Yeah, this is 0 line. This is positive, and this is negative. So it's weird. Now if we go to 10 volt, there's another line you can see still look like a dip, but this is now the signal actually is negative.
In the previous slide, it
moved upside down. Previous slide? Yes, because it's negative. The axis is negative, so it was going up. Yeah, it's fine. That's what I'm trying to tell you.
Yeah. So how this plot is related to the plot
of the
field? Both are negative.
Just depends
on.
If you say you pick up here or pick up here, you'll just see different things. Yeah, it doesn't really matter. So what the feature is, you will see a dip going up. I mean, I can have a dip going up too, right here. You will see it. Depends on how I do it. You know. Depends on the specific gate configuration. This is a very complicated. So now you see the signal actually pointing down. For this particular one, because we set a gate to make it pointing down. So this one I'm trying to show you, there's a weird feature. You will have saturation going, and then you have sense switch, then somehow you have a peak going down. It's more like enhancement. Then, like I say, we can tune it. For example, at this particular gate, minus 44.2 volt, this black curve here shows the saturation effect. The black curve here shows the Foley current without pump. And the red curve shows the Foley current with pump. So in this case, you know, we basically what we do is we fix pump probe at a zero time delay. Then we sweep the top gate continuously. So I want to see how the signal at this dip changes function of gate. At this gate, we will see basically with pump on, the Foley current actually always smaller than the Foley current with pump off. But above zero, so you always see saturation. Then I can tune my gate to some different configuration. Now you see this. You will see at this regime, a flow can actually switch signs. Right, the red line is negative and the black line is positive. And at this regime, you will see the red line actually has larger flow current than the black line here. So this is the corresponding to enhancement factor here. Looks very complicated, but actually interpretation is very simple. I mean, if we do analysis, basically it shows you have a, like I told you, you have a built-in electric fields and you have these similar electric fields. And it turns out in the PN junctions, actually both effects are there. And the magnitude and the sign, you can tune by tuner junctions. So we can tune these two signs actually to opposite each other, right? When they opposite to each other, so they will contribute for, they will cancel each other, for example. Then these two effects actually, they have a different saturation level. I mean, basically these data tell us, these photoelectric and thermoelectric, they saturate to different power levels. for example, you pulse coming, let's say, basically what we understand here is that the thermoelectric actually saturated much stronger than the photoelectric effects. Then the photoelectric stands out. So what you see is it looks like the photoelectric switch sign of the photoelectric enhancement, but it doesn't. It just means actually one mechanism dominates in certain gated voltage regimes. Let's see.
Which one are you killing first?
The thermoelectric.
Thermoelectric.
How much time I have, actually?
Fifteen.
Okay. Probably we'll finish the graphene part of them. We probably won't have time to talk about the others. But we can talk about today. So to show you, we also look at these graphene metal contact and they show very similar behavior. So for example, in this case, when the pulse laser came in and you do pump flow measurements, you have this saturation, but this starting with saturation, but with this pink already go above zero. So you have sense switch, and then you have enhancement. But if we keep tuning gated voltage, in this case, we tune the gate from this is a hole dope to electron dope. So we'll see in this direction, Sorry, this is electron dope, and then we go back to hole dope. So you can see saturation, switch, enhancement, and saturation again. So in this graphene metal contact. This we just report it, we normalize data, and this pink goes below zero, shows a sense switch, but the black line, you see it, this is one. So we normalize the data to the baseline. So we see this one actually, the photoelectric is larger than one, it goes two, basically it's enhanced. And we believe it's the same mechanism. Okay, now we go to this interesting topic here. So you get a lot of very interesting questions, how this electron phonon interacts, right? And back to 2009, Alan McDonald, they have this theory and it shows actually in the graphenes, if you just consider these electron and Coulomb phonon interactions, actually the interaction is weak. The reason is because in graphene, this electron phonon is interesting, have a quasi-elastic scattering. So what it means is, then each scattering, you only transfer the energy from electron to phonons proportional to h kf times s. S is the sound velocity of the acoustic phonon. So the sound velocity is it's about 10,000. But then you look at these carriers. The carriers actually have Fermi velocity only out of 10 to the 6. So it's 100 times larger than the phonon velocity. So what it means is each collision, there's not much energy transferred to the phonons. So this, basically the energy transfer process is weak. The other way to say it is there's a phonon bottleneck to cool these hot carriers. So what they calculated, they found out is this cooling should happen only out of a nanosecond. It's very slow, but you can already see what we have actually, the cooling is only out of picosecond, right? To 10 picosecond, it's much faster than what they calculated. So that's the reason. And the reason there's a theory came out, and this is from Levitov's group, actually. So when he visited my lab last November, I talked to him all this data, and he said, actually, we have a theory for that already. So they came out this paper, and it shows basically what the simple idea is. First of all, the electron, they still transfer energy to the phonons. Okay? But then we have to conserve the momentum, right? So what the model uses is called disorder-assisted phonon scattering. So we have a disorder here. This disorder will provide this recoil momentum back to the lattice, then conserve the momentum. So through this disorder acoustic phonon scattering, and actually you can increase the cooling power dramatically to enhance these cooling mechanisms. So you can get this faster cooling. But they calculate this cooling can. So this here's the theory they have, let me show you. So we have two different models for cooling. This one is just a normal linear, linear proportional temperature difference between electron and the phonon. But you have this called disorder acid phonon cooling proportional to the cube of electron temperature minus the phonon. Then we found this cooling time have this complicated formula here. So how can we identify it? I mean, of course, we say we observe this temperature scale, the cooling scale on the order, for example, to 5 picosecond. But is this direct evidence? I mean, these somewhat direct, but they also show this cooling time as function temperature has this behavior. Okay? So basically, if it peaks at a certain temperature, then it also depends on the. So here's a three curve here. This curve shows the cooling time as function temperature. So they peak at a certain temperature. And then once they change the carrier impurity density, for example, in this direction, you change the impurity density, you will see the cooling time change in this place. Okay?
So A should depend on the elastic scattering time, maybe, the coefficient of the tolerance.
Yeah? A?
Yeah.
A is, it's much more complicated, but it depends on, I don't remember exactly what's the formula inside, but it depends on the impurity densities. And then also the carrier density.
Are those acoustic ones?
Excuse me?
Are those acoustic
ones? No.
It's optical
ones? For this one?
What's the collisions?
For this disorder, it's just cooling, you mean?
It's acoustic.
Yeah. It's acoustic form.
Oh, this is acoustic form, yes.
So acoustic form.
Yes.
Does it take into account that the impurity are moving to be the response?
Can I repeat your question? I'm sorry.
Do they take into account that impurity move together with acoustic photons? If you move the lattice, you move the impurity
together. I don't think so.
Okay.
Maybe in this abstract.
What?
It may be a charge impurity in this abstract.
There could be all different kind of impurity. There could be just, you know, like dirt on graphene. Or there could be, like he mentioned, it's a Coulomb potential, for example.
Well, in a normal metal, the impurity leads to precisely opposite effects.
Mm-hmm.
For the electron forming cooling, it basically changes the power to higher power from T to the 4th to the T to the 6th.
Mm-hmm.
And here, just an opposite.
Yeah. You know, the reason, because I can tell you, right, at the beginning.
But there are two opposite effects. One of them is the phase volume, and the other is the matrix element. And basically, normal metal, it turns out that, as a matter of fact, matrix element for such a collision vanishes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can talk about this after this. I'm interested, actually.
Is it positive phonon or transverse
phonon?
Is it phonon in plane or out of plane?
It's in plane
phonon. I think in plane phonon, what they propose in the paper.
Cool.
We can discuss about it. I think it's interesting because this is a sort of a tentative interpretation I borrowed from them, you know, because they agree with our data. You can see, this I'm going to show you. So let's say this is a dynamic curve I measure at a low temperature. This is 20 Kelvin data, okay? Then we increase temperature to 50 Kelvin, and then we see this relaxation gets slower. Then if we go higher temperature, 120 Kelvin, now you can see the relaxation gets faster. So we can map the whole thing out. So I can extract the relaxation rate or relaxation time as function of temperature. We see these peak features here. And these two curves are actually, because we tune out different carrier densities. I can show you more data. This might be related to your questions. So we tune on carrier densities, and we can see these peaks are different in temperatures. And it's sort of similar to what they propose here. So this is a, like I said, these are interpretations I sort of just borrow for now, but that doesn't mean, like I said, maybe it's not correct. But we show very remarkable agreement, sort of, at least feature-wise.
And the dependence and the bond density is the right one?
It's not the right one, actually. They propose different. What we found so far?
At lower density, you expect stronger scattering time. If it's coming from the substrate, let's assume that we're going to go. Then the scattering will be stronger at low densities, and then the red curves will.
Actually, red curve is
the black curve, I suppose.
Right, but this is not what we observe. Yeah. This just to show you the typical data, so we have a lot more. I can show you that. Yeah.
Only one fitting parameter.
For this one?
Yeah.
Yeah, only one fitting. And now that one, that's two fitting parameters going on, the A and the B. All right, let's see. Should I stop here or keep going? No, it.
10 more minutes. You started later, so.
All right. So here's something I think is pretty interesting, and you guys may have a lot of questions too, and we're still working on it. So we look at this fault congestion actually in these topological insulators. The reason we start this, we think they have still have these gapless separate states of these three-dimensional topological insulators. They look like graphene. So I want to know what's the difference between these two materials. And I will skip this motivation. Everybody knows what it is. I would just point out that there's recently one work came out and you get this group at MIT. They also look at this photo current from this bismuth selenide. I want to talk to you because I want to show the difference between our work and their work. So in that case, they look at the thin film of bismuth selenide. And the device structure is on the order of 10 micron. But their laser spot actually is 100 micron. So it's not a spatial result measurement. Basically, you think about, I have a little sample here, like this, but my laser spot is this big, cover the whole thing. Okay? Then, but they move the sample. So here's my big laser spot, like this big. So they move the sample across the center of the laser. So they sort of still map out what's the photon response in position. And then we see now they have a dip and a peak from these two contacts. They claim these two from a thermoelectric. And then they have some photon in the middle, maybe not a thermoelectric origin. So they attribute this to something related to the spin effects. Okay, so they see this, the major thing they do is they do this classical circular or linear photovoltaic effect. I'm not sure how you guys familiar with it, but all the measurements are very similar to what Ganitchev's measurements on this gallium arsenide system. So you have a so-called circular photovoltaic or linear photovoltaic when your light's coming in certain angles. So they see this helicity-dependent measurement, helicity-dependent response, and they attribute this dependence to the spin response, the surface spin response. Okay. So this is the summary of the previous work. So what we do here is, we look at the nano ribbons, okay? And you guys already asked, our laser spot is about 1 micron. So we can sort of spatially resolve what's the photocurrent pattern on the device. And the device we use called nano ribbons, bismuth selenide. So we adopt a method from the Stanford E-Trace group. So we grow these topological insulator nano ribbons. And this is just SEM image. You will see they have a ribbon or very thin films, all kinds of them. Then we pick those ones on the order of 2 microns. And this is the SEM image of one of the device. And now, once we shine light on, you will see these striking patterns. You will see edge photocurrent. So this is from here to here is on the order of 20 to 25 microns. We can make device, for example, to 40, 50 microns. They still show this kind of striking pattern. So blue color, red color means this photocurrent actually has opposite signs. This is a photocurrent image, this is a device image. So these two red lines here shows the contacts. And the black dash line shows the edge of the samples. And the current seems like uniform, they're dominated by the edge, and there's not much current come out from the contacts. Also, I talked this to Levitov when he came here, and he also told me we have a theory for that, actually. So basically, he's saying you can check out his paper. And first of all, what's striking, you can see, right? There's a uniform photocurrent, sort of uniform along the edge. Doesn't matter where the laser is. So it doesn't matter how the laser respect to the spot of these two contacts. Doesn't matter the distance. The photocurrent seems like uniform. So he explained this using this Shockley-Raymond theory. I'm not sure you guys familiar with, but the basic idea is, let's not talk about Shockley-Raymond. The basic idea is you have two plates form a capacitor, okay? Then you put a dipole into between these two plates. Then just very simple from the calculation, you will see it doesn't matter doesn't matter the distance of this dipole to the top or bottom plates. The induced charge on these plates will be the same. We'll determine it by the amplitude of this dipole. So what we have here is we have this kind of EMF generate. So this is similar to the analogy I just showed you. You will have we call this Shockley-Raymond theory. It doesn't matter where my EMF is. You always have a similar photocurrent. this is the first feature. The second feature, we have these two equidistant. So the hand-waving explanation, I mean, the explanation he has in his paper is, as long as we have these gapless and a Carroll material, you will have these two-way photocon. I call this two-way photocon. I mean, probably not the best way, but you will have these features. So you can take a line cut across a sample, across this map, you will see one side is negative, one side is positive. And we also did a parasitic dependent, but in these measurements, it's very different from this circular or linear photoway. What we did is, actually, our lace is perpendicular to a sample, so it's a normal instance. In conventional circular or linear photovoltaic effect, the light actually comes in with certain angles. We also did that measurements, but that's not much difference. So in this case, in this graph, we have a laser light that is parallel to the sample, the vertical axis, or to the edge. And this one is horizontal, okay? Then you can see that that's a very pronounced polarization dependence. This is a spatial map we just take from here. Then we can just pick a point from both ends. Then we plot it out. This is we change the, for this map I'm plotting here is a linear polarization. So I change the linear polarized light with respect to the edge, okay? Once we tune the polarization, we see there's a very clear polarization dependence. Of course, they're sitting on background. And this can be fitted by this function here. I will show you later. This function, basically, we can calculate it from just Hamiltonian rhythm. Then we also try the circular polarized light. And you can see it also depends on circular polarization. In this part, I already take off. I already subtract the background. Basically, I subtract the background, I fit the data, and show you this is left circular price, this is right circular price, they have a very pronounced difference. So we tried starting with this Hamiltonian, borrowed from either Charles King or Liang Fu's paper. And we inserted this optical interaction into it. And we can reproduce the major experimental results we have. Here I will give you a hand waving explanation what's going on. So let's just focus on this Rauschenberg Hamiltonian here, right? In these topological insulators, you have a spin momentum locking effect. So what it means is if you have a spin in y direction, then you will have a momentum in x direction. So a spin will move in x direction. Then you have a spin current. But without optical excitations, everything is in thermal equilibrium. So what it means is there will equal number of electrons or spins move into two directions, and you won't see anything. There's no charge current. Then the key part is how can we use light to break this thermal equilibrium. So I'm not going into details. We don't have much time. But what we have is basically if we tune lights to this edge, we create more spin oriented in this way than the spin oriented in the other way on the other edge. So you create a spin imbalance. Then you have this the spin imbalance will cause this charge current. So what we detect here is a charge current. Okay. Then we can do a different thing. If we laser spot on the other edge, you will see the same effects. You will see different sign of photic current. Then if at a low temperature, when these spin diffusion lines is long, so what it means is we cannot create this spin imbalance, then we should see almost this feature should disappear. So this is what we observe. This is a room temperature, and close to room temperature, this is a low temperature. We see the pattern almost disappear. So we can extract the amplitude, just plot a function temperature. You know, this is room temperature, this is low temperature. You can see the evolve of this photocurrent. Okay, I think I will stop here. We can talk about if you guys are interested. There's another thing we're working on is the valleytronics thing. I think you guys all know valleytronics in graphings. And that's graphing probably not the best system to look in these valleytronics. First of all, the theory is coming from my friends. Like I say, I like to talk to the theorists. So they come out with theory. They tell me I should work on this. I say it's difficult. The reason is, if we want to generate this valley magnetic moment, we need a system with we need a system with a broken inversion symmetries. However, in graphing, it's even on the breaking reverse symmetry, what you can do for barrier graphing, right? You can generate a band gap by applying vertically electric fields. But that band gap is very small. It's really hard to do it because there's no good way to detect the luminescence coming out from, for example, at the 5 micron or 10 micron, at least a far infrared, middle infrared to far infrared. Because a photon just not many photon come on. That's no good detectors there. So as a theory is fine, but we do experiment. I told them we cannot do it. And then I talked to them, actually, there's a new thing come out. You know, it's new relatively, from molybdenum and sci-fi. And Tony Han's group, also from one group, they demonstrated for single layer molybdenum disulfide, actually they become a direct band gap. In a bulk, molybdenum disulfide is an indirect band gap. But if you go down to single layer, it's a direct band gap. You have very strong luminescence. I tell them there's a very interesting features of this molybdenum disulfide. My friend clicked. They said, okay, if we look at this molybdenum disulfide, you know, single layer, they have a hexagonal layer structure, but they don't have an inversion symmetry. This is, for example, this is a molybdenum atom, this is a sulfide atom. If you take inversion symmetry, you will map this atom to an empty space. So molybdenum sulfide has this lattice, this hexagonal lattice structure, but with broken inversion symmetry. Then, just from the symmetry argument, we should have this valley associated magnetic moment. Then we should have these circular selection rules for these two valleys.
So is the gap at the K point or at the gamma point?
This on the K point.
That's assuming that the gap in molybdenum is at the K.
You can calculate from the first principle calculation. This shows on exactly like a graphene on a K point, but difference is you have a big band gap. This band gap is in a visible wavelength. So I like it because now we can do experiments. Then, this is just the first experiment that we did. And so if you want to resolve this valley polarization, you know, the simplest experiment we can do is just do polarization resolved for the luminescence. Then this is sample, actually pretty small. We have a single layer valley. Today I'm going to just show you the single layer. Then let's say we have this particular sigma plus or sigma minus. Let's say we have sigma plus light coming. Then we can resolve the luminescence by polarization resolve the detections. We can either detect sigma plus or sigma minus. So this is a long piece of data. Let's say we have a sigma plus polarized light coming, then the red line is we detect with sigma plus luminescence. The black line is we detect sigma minus luminescence. You can see big difference. So basically, the photon emission, the luminescence actually is polarized. So this just show there's a valley polarization, which is a sigma plus. We can reverse, we can do sigma minus excitation, then do a same detection. Now this time we have a more sigma minus than sigma plus. The valley polarization is reversed to -28%. So these are simple measurements basically shows this, in this molybdenum disulfide system, we really have these optical selection rules.
But how is it different from selection rules in gallium arsenide? If you excite,
I'm not saying that different.
Gallium, okay. So then, what exactly?
No. But the difference is this is from valleys.
Right. But it's a theoretical concept. What's the experimental difference between this one and the gallium arsenide? Let's suppose that you didn't.
No, that's no difference.
Let's suppose that you didn't know that. About the band structure, let's suppose that actually you would have absorption in a gamma point, not a K point.
Mm-hmm.
Would the experimental result be any different?
I don't think so.
For a model,
yeah.
But that's more than that. I mean, you just use very simple analogy. I mean, that's more going to it, right? Like you say, with a single model layer, we have this, first principle calculation. They show,
okay.
This,
yeah. Okay.
Even, for example, I give you a gallium arsenide, let's say. We start with gallium arsenide. We don't know what's the structure of gallium arsenide. Shouldn't lighting, you get this same thing. You still need to understand what's going on. So you have some, you're starting from calculation of stuff, then you understand why you have this selection. All right, I will just conclude here. This is all my collaborators and my students. You know, like I said, I'd like to talk to theorists, so there's maybe some faces you're familiar with. And thank you guys for attention and a lot of interesting questions.
going back to your idea to create speed imbalance in topological insulator, okay? If you look at the graphene nanorima, let's say zigzag graphene nanorima, the edges are polarized magnetically. So if you create a defect or on one edge, or it's a line of defects on one edge, then you can induce some spin polarized currents.
Yeah.
So in your idea about shining light on one of the edges of the topological insulator to create spin imbalance, what is the problem?
It's different. We're not directly optically created these spins. I'm not a polarized spin. What it does is here is, so this is a scenario we proposed, okay? So what's happening is you're basically shining, and we don't directly excite with a plus or minus spin, so we create a pool of spins in all directions, okay? Then this spin is going to diffuse spatially. Basically, I have a spin from this end diffuse to this end. Then the scattering will causing the diffusion from here to here, actually, will be less spin diffused to this end because there's longer diffusion length. Then you create a spin imbalance. Yeah. So that's why I show you the temperature dependence. At low temperature, when the spin diffusion length is longer, in your scenario, then what it means is basically spin without less scattering, right? You can get to the other edge. So there's no.
Okay, so you can evaluate, you can estimate what is a typical.
Yes. So right now, the experiment we're trying to do is we're trying to vary the length of these crystals and see how we can really extract the spin diffusion length. If, for example, to test if our model is correct.
What about the thickness of your ribbon?
Yes, it's important actually. So what we found is that this ribbon we use is on the order of 500 nanometer to 700 nanometer. So if you think about, let's say, we also try with the thinner ribbons. In a thinner ribbon, we don't see this effect. So it's very clear what it means. I think the scenario is, of course, could be wrong. But basically, you have two surfaces, right? If you excite the bottom surface too, it's exactly opposite to the top surface. You not see anything. So you have to use the thick to make sure that you don't excite the bottom surface. You only look at the bottom surface. Yeah.
Was the molybdenum disulfide can be gated.
Yes.
Can you check if the carriers are still in one body or another, or they come from
this experiment is ongoing. And first of all, in these two valleys, when you and they have the same energies, the energy degenerate. So we tune the carriers. You're not going to do any energy result measurements. But I can tell you that something interesting is in a bilayer graphene. In a bilayer, this molybdenum sulfide, actually they have inversion symmetry, just like a bilayer graphene. But however, we can do the same thing as a bilayer graphene. You can apply gate, just break the symmetry. Then you can generate these value polarizations. And we do observe these. I don't have data here. But there's something very interesting.
So that rules out that the carriers come from
impurities. Right. I think we can tune the intensities of these by tuning the gates. Yeah, that's something quite interesting going. We're trying to, finish up the measurements. Yeah.
So for this Wismut 7 samples, so do you say that in your experiment you see some sort of confirmation of the fact that the conductance is mainly from the sample due to surface and not due to bulk? So can you say that if there would be, because usually, in transport measurements, you will have a hard time to get in a regime where the conductance would be surface dominant. They always have some bulk. So do you say that your experiment favors the fact that the surface states dominate,
that
the result would be different if there would be a, say, considerable bulk?
So in this case,
bulk states
in this case, we have a lot of carrier dopings too. First of all, but the measurement is different here. First of all, we don't apply any bias. Okay, there's no bias involved. And the second thing is, so bulk, basically bulk is a symmetry system. Bulk system, right? In a symmetry system, in theory, you're not going to get any current come up unless you break the symmetry. do something. And the results we have in a box system, just from the Hamiltonian, we won't get these kind of these two spatial patterns here.
So you see that even if bulk is conducting, you will not see this effect just because of symmetry.
So that
you see, but then.
I mean, to my knowledge, I didn't.
The observation has nothing to do with this material being topological insulating.
No. It is. You have to have these gaps of states. No gaps, we cannot see this. I mean, to my knowledge, there's no such thing happen. I mean, I don't know anybody report anything in any materials.
But there might be also bulk states, and this would not the same energy, and this would not. Because for topological insulators, it was important that you have really a gap in the bulk, that you have gapless surface states and no other states. Otherwise, it's not a sort of truly a topological insulator. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And once again, in transport measurements, people have a really hard time to get to the regime, and I don't think there was any experiment that would show clearly that transport is due to sort of surface. Yeah? So now I just try to understand to what extent your result shows.
Yeah, I show it's a several states. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you say that bulk doesn't contribute because of some.
No, I'm saying that bulk doesn't contribute to a current.
The bulk contributes towards absorption.
Yeah, I think so. It will.
Then how do you know if it does not contribute towards current after you?
Doesn't contribute to this type of thing.
You produce no equilibrium carriers. How do you know they?
No, it's a symmetry system. How do you get a current come out? You need to break the symmetry. You need to generate, either apply bias or do other things with them. For example, we can apply bias to it, but we still see the same patterns, for example.
Have you tried this experiment on a system? Well, there are many of these materials.
Yeah, like I say.
That are known to have. You have bulk states.
So that's an infinite system. I mean, we cannot test everything, right? Like I tell you, to my best knowledge, in all the system reported, there's no such thing observed. I mean, I cannot test all the systems. Mm-hmm. That's impossible for me. It's difficult to demonstrate something not there, you know what I'm saying? It's much easier to demonstrate something with it's positive, yes.
But what you could do is to contaminate your sample on the surface. Once you measure that, then you deposit whatever magnetic impurities, for instance.
Oh, yes, that's something we're going to do. Yeah.
Until the signal persists, right. Is destroyed.
Yeah. We're going to try to apply magnetic fields, for example. But magnetic fields itself are causing problems. For example, you know, once you have magnetic field, you will also this kind of linear photovoltaic coming because you turn on this. You turn it on, it's a magnetic field. So it's hard to distinguish, you know what I'm saying?
Do you know if there would be any dependence in the width?
Yeah, that's what I was saying. We're trying this.
Okay.
We're trying, it's not a one-day measurement. We basically try all different kind of widths, different kind of lengths, and see how the effect changes. So far, it's all consistent. That's what I can tell you. Yeah, this is all very bizarre stuff, and it's not easy to understand. I appreciate all the questions you guys ask, and because we ask the same question.
Do you see an application about this type of thing?
Applications? I don't know application. I mean, I can bullshitting say, you know, this is great for dispersionless electronics, optoelectronics.
No,
sensing
or you have nothing really in mind, or you're not the target. You just explore fundamental physics. You have no targets.
I'm not really targeting anything, really application. Well, of course, when I talk to an agency, I tell them we can do this to them. Here, I don't know.
Be careful, this is recorded.
But who knows, right? In 10 years. It could turn into big applications. So what we're trying to do is understand the fundamental property first. and hopefully real engineer can turn into applications. That's what we do. I'm not qualified to talk about applications, that's something.